Good. Tonight, I like to speak about a territory of which I expect you are by now familiar. It's the territory of the hindrances, specifically the meditation hindrances, called Nivarana in Pali language. And these Nivarana not just happen to bad people, but they happen to all good people. That's what's happening on the wrong side of jhanas. That is the sort of stuff that is happening on this side of a profound meditative stillness, which Buddhist psychology calls jhanas. So the stuff that stops you from actually experiencing jhana is precisely these five hindrances that are in one or the other way present. And before we go into the phenomenology and the psychology of these hindrances, I'd like you to quickly listen to a brief account how these occur in the scriptures. There are a couple of passages in the scriptures where these hindrances are mentioned. One of them is, a charming story. And this story begins with a man called Sangarava. He is a Brahmin of his caste, so he comes to the Buddha. He's obviously an inquisitive Brahmin, and he comes to speak with the Buddha, and he says he is probably not a young man anymore. I'm no longer sure right now, but he doesn't sound like a young man. He says to the Buddha, and footnote here, you have to think, as a Brahmin priest, one of his tasks was to memorize the Vedas. Yeah, in the Buddha's day, there were three Vedas were known, and one of the tasks of a Brahmin priest, not all Brahmins were priests, but of Brahmin priests, was expected that they know the Vedas by heart. They didn't write them down, but they knew them by heart. They have learned the chants, the chandas of the Vedic scriptures by heart from the teachers, and it was their task to memorize those, to recite those on the proper occasion, but also to pass them on to their disciples. Now, this is a precious job, and this was a very powerful, besides its spiritual significance, it was a powerful mnemonic task. So to commit something to memory and to keep it in memory and to be able to reproduce it is a major job. If you have tried to keep a couple of poems by heart, or even a Buddhist sutta, you will know what I mean. Yeah, this is something that generally takes constant effort. Yeah. Monks, when they learn the Patimokkha, and who knows, we hope that we soon have enough bhikkhunis that they will be very widespread and recite their own Patimokkha, their own monastic discipline, practice this sort of stuff. And it's quite an effort to keep something in mind, a text, to bear it in mind and be able to reproduce it. You take a lot of effort to bring it into your mind, and then when you know it very well by heart, you need to keep practicing because it just fades. Yeah. Any larger chunk of text you have memorized just fades. You need repetitive practice throughout the time you want to use it. I know nobody who can simply recall large chunks of text without practicing. Once you have practiced it, you know, it's generally there and it just kind of gets a little bit wobbly around the edges or a bit blurred in the passages that lead from one segment to the other. But basically, if you don't practice, you lose it. Yeah. So our Brahmin named Sangarava comes to the Buddha and says, how come that there are days when I can't remember the things I have learned very well by heart? And then there are other days when the things that I haven't even properly learned, I can easily recite. How does that come? What is the reason for this? Why is it that my mind on one occasion is capable, even with minimal effort, to recall something and reproduce it? And why is it that on other occasions I have great difficulties reproducing something that I have learned with great effort and rehearsed with great diligence. And then the Buddha says, well, this is the case because of the five hindrances. Yeah. Now let me tell you how this works. And then the Buddha tells him a story. And the story says, there is a man who would like to recognize his own face. And for that purpose, he goes and seeks out a vessel with water, with the wish to look into that vessel and mirror his own face so that he can recognize himself. Yeah. Psychologists among you, isn't this a beautiful Jungian example of the path of self-recognition, going to recognize one's own face in something that mirrors it? Yeah. So, these five hindrances are what stops the mind from recognizing one's own good, the good of others, or what is good for others, and both one's own and the good of others. Yeah. So what are these five hindrances? Let me leave the analogy and let me name those hindrances. The first one is kama chanda. Kama means this is the sensory world. Anything to do with senses is called kama. An Indian version of the god of love, which we would call Cupid in English, is called Kamadeva. Yeah. It's a god that is highly interested in sensory experience. Now, kama is both sense world, it is sense enjoyment, and it is also the attachment to sense enjoyment. Yeah? The whole domain goes together. Yeah? This, for example, here, this world here is kama loka. We are living in kama loka. This is a world that is highly defined by sense experience. A little below us are hungry ghosts, and a little further below are hell realms. A little higher up, we have rupa loka, we have the fine material world. Yeah. If you want a psychological equivalent for that, you would have jhanic experience, meditative refinement. If you want a psychological experience for a hungry ghost, then this is a creature that never gets enough. Yeah, I'm sure you have met many hungry ghosts in your life. Yeah. There's people who never get enough. However much they get, they never get enough. Hungry ghosts, they have very small mouth and very big bellies. They have a huge amount of hunger, but you can't really feed them properly. So this world is full of hungry ghosts, as you're probably in agreement with me. But back to kama. So kama is that what defines our world. We cannot live without sense activity. We define ourselves. We operate in this world through sensory activity. Now, kama is not alone mentioned. Yeah, there is another word in there called chanda. And chanda means, in this case, it's a form of desire. Yeah? It's an eagerness or a keenness to be stimulated. We want something that is nice to experience for us. Kama is not just sex and food. Yeah, let's be straight about this. These are expressions of kama, but there is a lot more to kama than simple, than the things we associate with straight pleasure or with lust or with ecstatic sensory experience. We are totally dependent on sensory experience. You know? We strongly are defined by what's happening in our senses. It's as dramatic how we underestimate that. We think we're not particularly greedy, or we think we're not particularly attached to sensory experience. So we're just natural. We're just kind of normal, organically interested in good things. Yeah. But how much we are attached to actually sense contact, sense stimulation, is dramatic when some of this falls away. When we go and retreat and suddenly you can't talk. Yeah? Or when you sit in the dark for a few hours. Yeah? This can be quite dramatic. Or when you have to go into quarantine for a couple of days because you have an infectious disease or something, and you can't touch people and people can't touch you. Yeah? So in moments like this, we generally feel deprived. We feel something that was totally normal for us, that we didn't think was particularly strongly sensual, we feel has fallen away, and we respond to that quite strongly with depression or with anger or with helplessness or with very lost psychological states. Yeah. So Kamachanda in meditation, and these five hindrances all deal specifically with a situation of formal meditation. I'm not speaking of life as it happens outside of formal meditation. I'm speaking now specifically of formal meditation. And it's important to understand this. Yeah? This is not a moral teaching. This is a teaching about the efficiency of meditation. And these five hindrances are stopping our meditation from gaining effectiveness. So sensory desire is one of the obstacles. Let me name the rest of the four. The next one is the opposite of sense desires. It's aversion. It's, well, sense desire is the wish to have something, experience something, own something, touch something, taste something, smell something, associate with something, even think something. This is also a sensory experience. The next hindrance is the wish that we can push something away. Yeah. It's aversion. It's the wish that something is not happening, that we don't have this experience. While the first one is an experience from the point of deficiency, where I am lacking something, I need something to make myself feel good. The second one is opposite. It's as it is too much. I want less of this. Less noise, less people, less responsibility, less demand on me. Yeah? So the second obstacle is generally the Pali word for it is vyapada, which means it's I wish something ill. It's the opposite of metta. It's the opposite of wishing well. Yeah? I turn my annoyance towards something. I focus my anger on something. I reject. The first one has the movement this, the second one has this movement. Yeah? So Kamachanda and Vyapada are the first two meditation hindrances. The third one is called Tinamida, which means sloth and torpor. Sometimes it is translated, but more clearly it would be drowsiness and numbness. Yeah. In formal meditation, this manifests as sleepiness, dopiness, you know, in whatever state, mild dreamy moments, right down to comatose absences. Yeah? So sloth and torpor are meditation obstacles, quite powerful ones. It's not just the sleep, it's also the numbness, which sometimes people experience in powerful ways, which and even confuse with peacefulness. Yeah? Some states that are peaceful are not necessarily alive. They may not necessarily be combined with mindfulness. They may simply be numb and stuporific and kind of insensitive. So this is a very fruitless type of state when it comes to developing deeper stillness, and particularly fruitless when it comes to actually gaining some insight. So sloth and torpor, tinamida, are the third obstacle. The fourth obstacle, again, are the opposite. The fourth obstacle has two parts. The first part is about body. It's called udaccha, and it means restlessness. It's an itchy quality in the body. It's something that doesn't let me sit still, something that keeps agitating the mind through strange physical symptoms. It has an impulsive quality, And you can see that easily at the beginning of retreats or towards the end of a sitting, you know, people start fidgeting or kind of the sneezing increases or you see kind of this kind of thing, or just people get jumpy. Yeah, this is not difficult to recognize. So that's the first part of the forced hindrance. The second part is not a physical restlessness, but it's a mental restlessness, and it has to do with your conscience. What is conscience in Hebrew?
Matzpun.
Okay. You know, matzpun can really work you hard, yeah? So you sit here, suddenly you have time, and then you remember things, and then it says, oh, what have I done? Yeah? What have I done? Yeah? Time and again, I have had people on retreat, after a couple of days retreat, they just kind of come to me and they tell me how dreadfully bad people they are. Yeah? And it's the silence, you know, amplifies the weight, the karmic weight of some of the things they have done or they have not done, which they should have, and it becomes more and more and more oppressive. Yeah? So, the second part of the fourth obstacle is called kukucha, which means it's a profound disquiet of the heart. And it has to do with that sensibility in our heart that is gauging our behavior in terms of our values and our ethical sensibility. So sometimes our behavior can differ quite substantially from what we actually hold as values. We can do things we would feel if other people did those things, this was pretty bad, yeah? And somehow we keep doing things we feel are pretty bad, but we don't acknowledge this to us, to ourselves. And in meditation, suddenly this connection is made. So there is a kind of profound disquiet coming up in our lives, in our hearts, in our meditation, that has to do with things we have generally done in our life outside of meditation. And it can make us quite unhappy. We can get quite worked up about this. So this is an obstacle. It's an obstacle not because the ethical sensibility is wrong. It's not generally not wrong, but right now you can't do anything about it. Yeah, right now you're in a formal meditation situation and you aren't actually able to address this issue. You can't go and apologize, or you can't make amends, or you can't fix it, or you can't at least say that you're sorry. So, as a recurrent pattern in your mind, it is something that stops you from becoming more still, and it stops basically the progress in meditation. The second part of this fourth hindrance is quite similar or quite related to the fifth of the hindrances, which is called vijikicca, and this one is doubt. Yeah, this is a profound state of doubt. Now, doubt is a very unpleasant condition to be in. Doubt is not simply a question we cannot answer. Doubt is a question we cannot answer, which we feel we need to answer right now. You know, it's a question we feel we should not have. Yeah. So there are many things I don't know. I don't know what I'll get for tomorrow breakfast. Yeah, but it doesn't really cost me much sleep. Yeah. Thank you. I will sleep much better now. Yeah. You know, there are questions which they don't really trouble us, yeah. But there are questions which do trouble us, isn't it? There are questions which we feel we need to resolve before we can make another move. And if we have doubt as a meditation obstacle, it stops us from pursuing anything with any determination. Doubt is a really disastrous quality because it takes away our capacity to act. It takes away our effort. It paralyzes. It undermines our convictions. it undermines our capacity to actually address something, to be responsible. We are no longer reliable. You know, doubt does all kinds of unpleasant things, particularly doubt about ourselves. Doubt about meditation, doubt about the Buddha, but generally doubt. In most cases, doubt is doubt about ourselves. You know, am I good enough to do this? Have I really understood this? Is this really for me? Am I too neurotic to really feel my breath? You know, are these Buddhists just going to take all the fun out of my life and leave me as a sort of dried up meditation mummy? Is that what they want to do with me? This kind of thing, you know. So we have these five hindrances, and you recognize patterns there, you know. The first one is about greed or desire. The second one is about aversion. So they are kind of a pair. The third one, sloth and torpor. And the fourth one, restlessness and agitation, again, are a pair. Yeah, they're in some ways opposites. And the fifth one is a glorious and effective solo player. So we're very thankful that he doesn't have a partner this one. So if we go back to the analogy, the Buddha then says, if our man looking to recognize his face in a bowl of water finds a bowl of water, but the water is colored with red color or with yellow color or with brown color, he gets an image of himself, but his image of himself is distorted. Yeah? So in such a way, the mind that is colored by desire is distorted. Yeah? There is also a pun in this which is lost in English. The word for desire, or for the verb for actual desiring something, or for being in a desirous state, is called rajati in Pali language, which means turning red. Yeah. So there's a play between passion and the color that passion creates. So which in Pali is the word, or in Indian languages, is associated with red. A very late, another footnote, the very late notion of this is the rajas in Indian ragas, yeah? The Indian raga, there the term is very softened and means mood, yeah? You have particular ragas, summer ragas, or winter ragas, or, you know, morning ragas, evening ragas. So there the word raga, which in Pali means passion or desire, has been changed into the notion of mood. Yeah? So that you make the connection. So the color that desire colors the mind with distorts what he recognizes. Yeah? When he wants to recognize his true self, he finds himself discolored. Yeah, by the passion that is operating in his mind. For the second obstacle, our mind finds a vessel with water that is bubbling. Yeah, it's boiling. So he tries to mirror his face and he cannot see his own mirror image because the water actually is throwing up bubbles. That's the image of anger, the image of aversion, the image of ill will. Yeah. Again, our man fails to recognize his face, and fails, to speak in the Buddhist words now, fails to recognize his own good, the good of others, and both his own and the good of others. The sutta has another interesting passage. He says, not just the person who is affected by desire or affected by aversion, but also the person who, when affected by desire or aversion, does not know how to still that desire or aversion. Yeah, there's another twist. It's more generous. You know, the Buddha assumes that we are affected by desire and aversion, but if we know how to find a way out of it, we are in a much better position. Yeah. So the person lost in any of those hindrances is really a person who not just has these, but when he or she has them, does not know what to do about it. Yeah. Implied, obviously, that we all have this. You know. This is, as I said, the honest question about meditation hindrances is not who has them. Yeah. Or could it be that I occasionally have some of them? But the honest question is, which one do I have now? Yeah. So the analogy for the third hindrance, the third is Tinamida. It's a man who comes and finds a vessel full of water that is mossy or covered with algae. Something green is growing at the surface of the water, and again, he cannot recognize his own face. He cannot recognize his own mirror image. Okay, I think you get it. The analogy for the fifth obstacle, for that of doubt, it is a water vessel. Oh, sorry, I have forgot the fourth one. The fourth one, Udacha Kukucha, is the water is whipped up by wind. Yeah. So it is as the mind is agitated, so the water is agitated, and again, our mind cannot recognize his face in the water. The fifth one, finally, doubt. The water is muddy. It's completely clouded with clay or mud. Yeah. So, again, our man looking into the vessel will not be able to recognize his true self in that way. So, let us look at these obstacles more psychologically. I appreciate your efforts to learn the Pali terms. but even learning those Pali terms doesn't actually really resolve the issue, or doesn't necessarily bring you in closer connection how this teaching translates into the psychology of your meditation. So let us look at this in terms of psychology. What we see is that 3.5 of those 5 hindrances are ways of thinking. Remember, we're speaking of a formal meditation situation. How does desire manifest when I am formally meditating? I sit here still, I look angelic, and how does it look like when I am in desire? Now, when I am in desire, then I will be thinking of things that are agreeable, that are pleasant to me. Either things that I have experienced and I fondly remember, and I enjoy the afterglow of the memory of something nice. Yeah, and I just kind of warm up once more or twice or half an afternoon and play with it, you know, really go through what exactly did we eat together when we did that whole 15-course, you know, supper. What was the exact sequence of hors d'oeuvres in there? Yeah. So you kind of meticulously go through this, and you recall the positioning of the plates, then, you know, the sauces you used for it, and so forth. Now, this is a classic example of desire. Yeah. The mind has found something pleasant, and in most cases, a mind that is not considerably trained will respond to the experience of something pleasant with the wish that it continues, that it increases, that it varies a little bit, that I can have it again tomorrow, and that it lasts as long as possible. Yeah. One of the reasons why Buddhists are so down on pleasure is not because pleasure is bad. Pleasure is not bad. The problem with pleasure is that most of the time we experience pleasure, first we have an experience of pleasure, and that experience is very, very innocent. And then we have a second experience and says, "Ooh, this is great, let me have another one." Yeah. So following on the pleasure is almost immediately a type of something Buddhist called grasping. Yeah. Grasping or clinging, attaching, identifying if it's mental, or holding on to if it's emotional. Yeah. We like to have more of it. We like to prolong it. We like to vary it. It was good, but it didn't quite hit the spot. Let me try another one. Yeah? So we go in there. If we are meditators and if desire is in our mind, then we seek pleasant things. We either get them out of our memory or we fantasize them. Yeah? We think what pleasant things we can do once we get out of this dreadful retreat. You know, whom you will be meeting, what you will be reading, which oils you are going to pour in your bathtub, you know, your next holidays, or you plan your next retreat, you know, where you really meditate, not like kind of in Endor, but say where you really meditate. That's the nastiest sort of desires, you know, kind of meditators' desires. You know, you sit on one retreat and you waste your time by planning your next retreat. So, you know, the English word desire or greed or lust, they all sound too strong. You know, it's important that we connect the pursuits of our mind seeking pleasure, seeking comfort, seeking stimulation, seeking gratification, that we acknowledge that this is happening all the time. Now, sometimes this is by memorizing or remembering, much is the proper word, not memorizing, but remembering. So we go back into the archives of our experience and say, there must be something nice, something that is more interesting than my breath now. Just give me anything. Yeah. So that's one way of engaging desire. And then we latch onto something and we invest into it. Yeah. Say, ooh, yes. And how was that exactly? Yeah. And we go. And we do that in thought, you know. We're not doing something immoral. We're not stealing. We're not hitting people. We're not, you know, no rape, no murder. We're nothing. In terms of moral, we're perfectly harmless. Yeah. The meditation hindrances are, in terms of morality, are perfectly okay. You can commit all the meditational obstacles and you stay morally still perfectly okay. The problem is not morals. The problem is samatha. The problem is collectedness, stillness of mind. So many things in terms of sila are perfectly blameless, but in terms of samadhi are disastrous. Yeah. Maybe even worse than warming up old experiences is fantasizing new experiences, because while the old experiences at least have some background and some reality, you know, they have some empirical validity, however distorted, embellished, or, you know, edited, airbrushed, you know, they have some basis in reality. But fantasies, there is no constraint on fantasy. You can fantasize anything. You know? So in your fantasies, you can be just about anything. And if you really invest in fantasy worlds, then meditation is fantastic for you. You know, you are kind of legitimized sitting with people whom you don't need to speak to, and you're left to your own devices for hours on end. You know, and you just kind of go into your fantasy worlds, and in there you're anything you want to be, and you really get a kick out of this. You know, whatever you do, solve mathematical problems, develop software, create poems, write music, indulge in sex fantasies, you know, anything you can spend your days with that. So desire will seek something pleasant, either as a memory or as a fantasy, and engage with this. And try to get, if it can't get the experience, it can get at least an echo of the experience. Yeah, and it will seek that. And the mind will engage. Yeah? And obviously this makes the mind mildly agitated. At the end of it, whether it's memory or fantasy, you don't have it. Yeah. You are left with some form of unstilled wish, some form of longing, some form of desire that is not satisfied, that you have just played with, you have just tantalized. You have to understand that this is harmless as it sounds. It is a profound disturbance to the mind. So that's why all meditative traditions have understood that one of the ways we need to find a clear relationship to the world of desire. It'd be stupid to just say, it's a bad thing, let's not do it, you know. That doesn't solve anything, you know. We have desire minds, you know. Our minds wish for things, long for things. What exactly? We differ a lot, but we all have some forms of longing. For some of us, this is just being left alone. For others, this is intensity and contact. Yeah? Both are forms of desire. And in meditation, they will manifest a thought. The second one very clearly also manifests a thought. Anger, ill will, aversion starts off generally as comment. It starts off as kind of apparently sober, neutral, rational statement, you know. She's a bit late, you know, this is the third time this morning. I've really seen it. Wonder, you know, is she not motivated or is she just lazy? Strange, yeah. It's really disturbing, you know. I've already half settled into my metta meditation and now she's, you know. You know, and you notice it's not the thought that actually betrays the aversion, it's the tone of voice that betrays the aversion, yeah. My aversions, they're always quite reasonable, very reasonable, in fact, they're true, yeah. They're very accurate, actually. And then there is an edge, you know, the edge is kind of, it's a sort of a vinegar quality in your blood, yeah? So a slightly sort of acidic note in your mind, yeah? And it can give you even the feeling that this helps you with, you know, it cuts through desire, it's very good, yeah? Yeah, cut through desire. I remember when I started meditating and heard about this, and I thought, oh God, thank God I don't have desire, just, you know, I got this sort of acidic quality, just look at anything and it turns ugly, you know. You just one look and you see the disadvantage of something, or you see the bit that isn't right. So I was, for a moment, I was even proud and said, desire? God, I don't have that. You know? And later on, when I really acknowledged desire, I was actually quite proud, because I realized I had conquered my aversion to a considerable degree, because right now I actually had desire, you know. So acknowledge again, desire and aversion both turn up as thought. Thought, in terms of aversion, is likely to be critical. It is likely to be sour. It is likely to have a sharp, grumpy, edgy, biting sort of quality. And often, if you don't listen to the kind of tone of the inner voice, if you just believe or follow the thought, it can be actually quite credible. Yeah. There is something in us that does not want to admit the degree of desire or the degree of aversion that is operative in our minds if we just follow the content of our thought. But the tone, the kind of voice quality of our thoughts often gives away the amount of desire, yeah, or the amount of aversion or ill will that is in place. Both of them are very powerful forces. Ill will is probably one of the strongest antidotes to samadhi. Yeah. If you really want to stop your mind from becoming quiet, just engage in anger. Engage in some forms of criticalness. You know. It is no secret that for a mind to come quiet, the mind will become a lot more quiet if it is loving, if it is caring, if it is soft, if it is what the scriptures call malleable. Yeah. And one way of preventing that is fragmenting it with aversion or with sourness or with critical, complaining, bitter, sort of slightly bitching sort of quality, sarcastic quality. This is very, very bad for meditation. Yeah. The next one is an interesting one. the stupor and numbness, sleepiness is an obstacle that is very famous amongst meditators. It is also connected with shame, because most of the other obstacles are not visible. Yeah, sleepiness often is very highly visible. Yeah, because we don't fall asleep all at once. You know, there are parts of us that fall asleep. Our senses are falling asleep one after the other. The first one to go is our sense of balance. Yeah. The last one to go is our sense of hearing. So when you fall asleep, while you think you're still at it, you know, and it's really peaceful, and, you know, you're really getting at it, this is way on, you know, you're right on track for, you know, the first jhana, then suddenly, you know, you realize it's really peaceful, yeah. You wonder, is this now neither perception nor non-perception? Didn't take me long. So, next moment is kind of the jolt. Yeah? Next moment of consciousness. You've kind of fallen off your little peg. So, sleepiness, we all know that, isn't it? It's something that any serious meditator will meet in his career. Because simply, you can't stay upright all the time. If you meditate long, if you meditate through days and nights, you know, you can't look good, you can't stay upright. You have to negotiate lack of energy. Yeah. Now, sleepiness is not always sleepiness. There are many reasons for sleepiness. One of them is just honest exhaustion. End of the day, you're tired, the air is thick, you know. You go drowsy, something is, you know, starts leaden sort of flow, and you kind of, yeah. So that's exhaustion. That's fairly straightforward. But there are many other forms of sleepiness. Sometimes sleepiness covers. Sometimes sleepiness covers aversion. Yeah, because it's easier for our mind to accept sleepiness than to accept aversion. Yeah, aversion is painful, and sleepiness takes away the edges. It takes away the pain. Yeah. So sometimes it is more preferable for our psychology to just fall asleep rather than feel the pain. Yeah. And particularly people with strong will experience that. Yeah, the mind refuses collaboration at some point. You know, the mind says things like, yeah, you can drag me into the meditation all in the morning, you can make me do these retreats, you know, you can make me get up early, you can do all this, but I'm not going to join, you know, as soon as I can. So it blocks. It says, you know, you can do anything with me, but I'm not going to play along. When you want me to become still and collected and concentrated, I just fall asleep. Bang. So that is often something that happens to people with, you know, powerful will. They're there, and then somehow, as soon as they get a little more quiet, they just conk out. You know? Yeah, I'm sure you have experienced that. You've not experienced it yourself, then I'm sure you've seen it. People can do quite suddenly, they can be quite alive and bright, you know. You know, and then they meditate 3 minutes and suddenly they go into this kind of pumping movement. And this is very, very common. So it is to do both with overstimulation on one side, if the speed of your life is such that you are moving fast, then a meditative situation can be a moment where you just kind of relax. And you just compensate for the amount of stress or speed you had before that, and you just go into the opposite, you know, which is kind of conk out. Sometimes it is the case that your psyche puts the brakes on. Yeah, if you're trying to face things in your own heart or in your own life or in your own mind, that your psyche feels you don't have the resources right now to deal with. It just may pull the brake, you know, sort of the emergency brake. I don't let him go there because it's too painful and he doesn't really have enough ground underneath his feet. So I'll just make him fall asleep. And he, whenever he gets near, he gets anesthetized, yeah, would be the word. So if you struggle with sleepiness, then this is something you need to investigate. Is it the sleepiness that goes away when I ring the bell? Were you absolutely bright awake before you came in, and as soon as I said meditate, you feel dreadfully tired? Is it the sort of thing that happens to you in a particular life situation or not? Yeah. So this is something that needs investigating, sleepiness. It's not just a matter of more effort or, you know, more power or more concentration. Often it is necessary to be more careful. Yeah. Particularly if you overrun parts in you that resist or that don't want you to be here, yeah, that would have preferred going to the beach and do more kite surfing rather than kind of go into meditation. You may have overrun those parts without properly negotiating with them. These parts take revenge. Whenever you should concentrate your mind, they kind of go into rebellion. And one way of doing that is making you fall asleep or just making you numb. You know? You go into sort of a feeling as if somebody had pulled a plastic bag over you and everything is behind cellophane or something. So if you struggle with sleepiness, you need to investigate this carefully. What's happening here? And take out the shame. Yeah, that's the worst of it, because we don't want to have it, so we try to deny it as long as possible. And when it's happening, we just kind of, you know, we hope nobody has seen it, kind of thing. Which stops us from really having the experience, and also not wanting to have the experience means that we are not actually having a chance to investigate it properly. Restlessness is quite honest. This is one of them that is not a thought. No. Sleepiness also is not a thought, although sleepiness often comes with sort of dreamy kind of thoughts, and often by following such thoughts you lose it. No. But strictly speaking, sleepiness is one of the 1.5 obstacles that are not thoughts. The other half is the physical restlessness. This is as if our body is producing quite desperately symptoms that stop the mind from collecting itself, that stops the mind from unifying. So it is like you sit here and suddenly you feel these ants walking up your neck, you know, or you feel a very strange sensation, as if your knee is kind of inflated, or as if your hip is on the right side of your body. You get all kinds of strange, funny, physical sensations that you never had. Now, if you're a bit anxious, obviously you think very quickly of bad things that can happen to you. Yeah. This funny little twitching feeling in my leg, this is probably, you know, it's my kneecap falling off. So depending, if you have a lot of anatomical knowledge also, you know, you can go really into paranoia, because you know all the things that can go wrong, you know. And if you give in to these sensations, that means generally you move your body, or you scratch, or you relax, or you do something, it doesn't stop. You know, it stops for a minute and then another symptom comes up. It is as if the body is inventing physical sensations to stop you from doing what you have decided to do, namely calming your mind and sitting still. Very easy to recognize. It's very easy to laugh about if you don't have it. If you do have it, it can be quite unpleasant. You know, you can have break out in sweats, or have tremors, or suddenly feel one muscle tensing up, or, you know, all kinds of strange things can happen, particularly around your skin. Yeah, skin is full of nerve endings and is completely easy to have all kinds of weird skin sensations. And then you think, there must be something crawling up my back, or, you know, something is really, really going wrong here, or I need to change posture, I need to look what it is, or I need to scratch, or I need to release that, otherwise my blood circulation is cut off, or my nerve is pinched. So it becomes a compulsive pattern of releasing something, And as soon as you have released, generally the symptom shifts to some other place of the body, and within shortest of time, it has reproduced itself. So you can sit around, relax particular muscles. You've got lots of muscles. I forgot how many, 288 or lots of muscles. Or is it 288 bones and even more muscles? You know, there's lots of them. You can kind of relax, or something can go wrong with. Let alone to speak of all the psychological things that can go wrong. You know, you could just sit here and breed a psychosis. You know, this kind of finally gets peaceful, and then you've got this open, spacious feeling, and you think, is this now samadhi, or is this just me turning mad? You know? Am I just going to transform into a big pink rabbit, or a cabbage, or something? The next one, anxiety, agitation of the mind, I think I've already described, because it has to do with things that have happened in my life where I have not behaved in ways that is in accordance with what I know, or in accordance with my values, or in accordance with my morality. Yeah. So these things catch up. That's one of the things meditation does for us. It allows us the space to that things catch up with us. Now, some of the things are unpleasant and we feel remorse. We feel we have done bad. We have not lived up to our responsibilities. We have been insensitive. We have been, you know, crude or greedy or angry. And we feel the pain we have caused, which is not a bad thing. The problem is that right now we can't really do anything about it. And it quickly turns into some sort of self-punishment. So I keep thinking the bad thing I have done. I can't quite fix it, but at least I can make myself feel bad. Yeah, I can punish myself a little bit and feel bad. It is something that has generally a strong sort of narrative tone. Yeah, there is a story going with it that has to do with my life, my biography, my socialization, my relationships, and usually you have right. Yeah, and yet at the same time, in this situation, it's perfectly useless. Yeah, you can't really alter it. You can't make it undone. You can't apologize, because right now you're sitting on a cushion trying to still your mind. Yeah. The last one is painful because it undermines all our efforts. Yeah. Anything that takes strength, that takes courage, that takes determination, that takes effort, that takes guts, that takes tenacity and vigor is undermined by doubt. You know, all these things are weakened. And if you are struggling with doubt, you will not have success in anything you try to do. Because whenever the first obstacle turns up and you go into doubt, you can no longer continue. You need the confidence, you need the stamina, you need the determination, you need to put in the effort, and doubt puts us in a sort of holding space. So doubt is something that is very, very... it's a strong weakener of our practice. Yeah. If we struggle with doubt, we often break our meditations. We stop pursuing our exercise. We change our postures. We just think, what am I doing here? Yeah. Does this really need any? Is this just, you know, joint wrecking madness what I'm doing here? Are these people all masochists that enjoy feeling bad and then believing it's any good for them? Or, you know, you go into a sort of a questioning that is corrosive, yeah, that takes away the things you know, that takes away the things you have decided, that takes away you feel clear about, that takes away a course of action. So the major activity of doubt is stopping you from doing what you're doing. Yeah. So it's necessary that you recognize these obstacles, these hindrances, if they turn up, because if they do turn up, they generally have a story. They generally have a couple of plausible thoughts. They usually use material from your history. Yeah? So they present that as if this was a genuine thought about your life. Yeah? But in fact, it is a doubt. In fact, it is a piece of self-hatred. In fact, it is a distracting form of desire. In fact, it is a vengeful moment of aversion against something. Yeah? And if these things turn up, it is necessary for you to recognize them. Recognize them, hey, this is annoyance. Second, meditation hindrance. Hey, this is, I'm obsessed with something. I'm infatuated with somebody. Or I'm obsessed with a project I'm not doing right now because I'm sitting here. Or I am paralyzed by sleepiness, by stupor. I can't be present because whenever I'm trying to be present with something, it's like I am being pulled away behind opaque curtains. Or I'm restless. Yeah. As soon as I need to sit still, I get a tremendous pain in my chest and it just doesn't stop. Yeah. It's gone as soon as I'm out here, but when I sit down here, it's here. Yeah. So be wary of those things. Don't just believe the story. They all come with a story, except sleepiness. They all come with a story. And if you believe the story, the hindrance has won. Yeah? Not because the story is wrong. It probably is to some degree, but worse than that, the hindrance that uses the story as a camouflage remains undetected. Yeah? Unfortunately, this is the bad news for tonight. There are no straight antidotes for these hindrances. They find their root in your life, yeah, in the way you live. So I can't give you meditational anti-nivarana pills or something like that. They all need to be negotiated quite carefully by reflecting where they find their root in your life. And about this, we need to talk some more, but not tonight. Let me stop here. I would like to ask if I can respond to questions to the five Nivarana, the five obstacles. Yeah? Please.
Just if you can repeat the colors of the bow.
Okay. So, our man that tries to recognize his own face and seek out the true nature of his self in the water, the first time for desire, the water is colored by red or yellow or brown. For the obstacle of aversion and ill will, the water is bubbling because it's boiling. Yeah? So the surface again is disrupted and he cannot mirror himself. The third obstacle is the sleepiness, drowsiness, tinamida. The water is mossy or covered with green algae, yeah? Cannot see his face. The fourth one, the water, this is restlessness and agitation, the water is whipped up by wind. It is moving, it has little waves, and is jumping, so he cannot recognize his face. And for the fifth one, for doubt, the water is muddy and troubled, yeah? By clay. Yeah. Anguttara, Book of Fives, if you're interested, yeah? Anguttara Nikaya, Book of Fives, Sangharava Sutta, for those of you who are interested. Gradual Sayings, as it's called in English, and it's in the collection of the items that are come in the group of five. Good. Other questions? Please. Well, generally, a sense of calmness, you're vitalized, you're bright and awake. You have, although the body is still and the mind is still, there is a sense of tremendous energy. It's tremendously alive. It's kind of like, you know, a pond that is beautifully still, but you sense it is very, very deep. Yeah. Usually the quality of mindfulness is determining factor. So in a calm that is what we wish for, you have a mobile quality of mindful awareness. Yeah. In sleep, this is gone. Yeah. In sleep, it feels numb, it feels flat, it feels you're not capable of touching something. You keep losing your capacity to actually engage with something. Yeah? You keep losing your capacity to be in contact. You squeeze your leg and it seems 2 seconds later that you actually feel the touch when you're really drowsy or sleepy. Get a feeling for the quality, what awareness feels, what sati feels like in your system. It's not there in sleepiness. That's the thing that goes out. Although sleepiness can feel quite calm, it has never the vitality, it has never the energy and the power of stillness of mind. Yeah?
Is self-critic related more to aversion or to doubt?
I would think it's probably related to aversion mostly. In the bad news is they can combine, you know, but I would think most of self-criticism is based on some form of not wanting to love oneself. Yeah, it's I would rate it more as the second. I would rate it more under the aversion than the doubt. It's profound. It's a profound one. You know, it often goes together with people who have trained their minds in critical ways, because critical thinking is indispensable in many ways, and we transpose that criticalness onto our self construct. So I would rate it in most cases to the second of obstacles. Yeah? Please.
If I'm feeling that my kneecap is going to fall off, so your advice is just to suffer it? To just, I don't know.
Has it fallen off so far?
I don't know, I don't like.
I think it's unlikely that your kneecap is jumping off. I mean, no guarantees, but it's unlikely. I have, in 30 years of meditation, never heard anybody whose kneecap suddenly jumped off. I think it's definitely worth investigating whether you can negotiate with the fear or with the pain. That is probably the reason for the fear. Your pain and your fear will have very, very different realities than the unpleasant sensation that is at the root of both. Yeah. And both fear and pain can appear very, very solid, very, very convincing, and in fact can change dramatically. Fear does not need to be founded. There is no guarantee that what you are afraid of is indeed risky and dangerous. You can be highly irrational in your fears. And pain can be disappearing quite dramatically. Even very powerful pains can suddenly collapse. Obviously, you are your own expert. Who am I to tell you how much pain you should take? But I would suggest you experiment whether you can take some, whether you can negotiate with that pain. If it's a pain that stops once you change your posture, that, say, is gone within 5 minutes, I think it's probably safe to make experiments with that sort of pain. If it isn't gone after 5 minutes, particularly if it's a knee, I wouldn't experiment. I would choose another pain to experiment with. Yeah? Okay. Yeah, please, Adam.
Mm-hmm. First, where does despair fit in? And second, how can confusion be differentiated from
okay, let me go to despair. Despair is not one of the classic meditational hindrances. So, there are many things not listed in those hindrances. Yeah. I think it's just the five worst ones, the five most obvious ones. Also, despair, the element of intentionality is less prominent in despair. Yeah, you notice the desire and aversion have a strong intentional quality. Yeah, while in despair, I think the affective quality is much more pronounced. Yeah, and less the intentional one. So, I can't fit it into the five hindrances. But again, you know, this is a small segment of the things that can happen in your mind. They're just five, you know, the tips of the five worst icebergs which are mentioned here. So, you know, you can go into... there are other states which are not listed in there. Let's say, grief is not listed in these hindrances, for example, and grief can be quite weighing on you. So, I wouldn't try to fit it in there. This is not the theory of what happens in human minds in meditation. It's just an outline of some of the five worst enemies for samatha. So let's not try to make of this list a bigger story than it is.
Yeah. It seems insufficient to just recognize them, because it's not uneasy to recognize these injustices when they come. Just root them.
Well, they're actually more difficult to recognize than meets the eye. You know, we're very inclined to jump to the story and go for the thought rather than the energy that propels the thought. Yeah, yeah. Are you staying on for the psychology retreat afterwards? I'd like to go a little bit into that one, but this is not the space for it. Just flagging. Yeah. Good. Other questions? Yes, please.
One of the options to one of the hindrances is basically to surrender to it, and maybe this is another time to meditate, and maybe go outside and do some catch your feet and come back meditating.
No, that's, I think, no. I'd like, he asks me whether one of the options to deal with this hindrance is just to surrender to it and say, well, this is not the time to meditate and just go out. Yeah. I would say no. I mean, if your restlessness reaches degrees that you start endangering your fellow sitters around you, or if your remorse reaches, you know, the heights that you feel like screaming and beating your chest or so. But generally, no, I think hindrances are to be faced, are to be tackled, are to be taken head on rather than give up and say, well, I go out and wait till it's over. Yeah, that is a victory for the hindrance. Next time you come in and sit, the hindrance knows, oh, well, I've got him to his knees once, and it won't be difficult to get him down to his knees a second time. Yeah, yeah, good. Please.
I wanted to ask, what is the motive of the mind doing that? I mean, why is it like this? What is trying to hide from me? I have another question.
Well, look, you know, human minds are complex. There are various desire systems at work here. So some desire systems, they want to get enlightened, and other desire systems, they just want to be left in peace. They just want to drink beer, watch TV, and don't do any sort of strange religious things or so. And these systems, they can live in the same human being. So, you need to decide which one you're going to follow. But even if you have decided which one you're going to follow, the other one is not gone. You know, he plays a few tricks. He throws around his weight. You have to understand that the human mind has powerful forces of awakening, but also powerful forces of darkness, of ignorance. Yeah. Because every time you understand something, the consequences of that understanding means more responsibility. You got to change something in your life. You got to do something. You got to own up to your new state of consciousness. And if you don't do that, you feel bad. So in many ways, it's kind of something in you says ignorance is bliss. I don't want to know, because when I know, I just need to do more complicated, difficult things. And I just want life to be simple and leave me in peace. Yeah. So that acts itself out when you sit still, because when you try to collect your mind, obviously the resistance begins to show its face. Yeah.
Once we've rooted this hindrance in our life and recognize where it's coming from, what then?
Well, if the hindrances are basically allayed, then the mind is still. You have a profound samadhi experience, and you see many, many things very, very clear in your life. Yeah. You understand things about your mind. You experience great bliss. Yeah. You experience a lot of energy. But even then, there is no guarantee that a week later you don't have hindrances. Yeah. The hindrances are not generally going away permanently. They go away permanently if you have great skill in gaining stillness. That's what stops stillness from happening. And on the other hand, when you are still, these hindrances are temporarily flat. Yeah. So these hindrances obviously can be stimulated again. You stimulate them with thoughts, you stimulate them with the very sort of experience they consist of, say. This hindrance of desire is stimulated by pleasure-seeking in your life. The hindrance of anger and aversion is stimulated by believing, engaging in, and affirming the critical nature of mind or the hateful nature of mind. The hindrance of sleepiness, drowsiness, and numbness is stimulated every time you follow ignorance. Yeah? The hindrance of agitation and of doubt and of remorse, they're all stimulated by forms of ignorance, anxiety, indecisiveness, this kind of thing. So there is a strong connection between these hindrances in your meditation and how you engage in your life. Yeah? But you don't generally rout them once and for all, and then they're gone. If that is the case, and you are permanently free of desire and permanently free of hatred, then you're pretty high up on the echelon of, say, sainthood. Yeah? Exactly, you're on the second last step. Yeah? If you have really done away with anger and with desire, you're an anagami. You have no longer any desire and any anger. That's the last step before you become completely enlightened. So I'm sure it's a good thing to do, but you know, it's unlikely to happen against your will. You know? And if it does happen, you will notice. Yeah. Good. A last one, please.
Our thoughts, whatever kind of thought that may appear, are necessarily indicates that a lack of stability, some lack of stability. In other words, our thoughts are bad. Should I not have them, or at least wanting not to have them, or trying not having them and replace them with breathing or some other kind of awareness,
mm-hmm.
not thinking?
No, our thoughts are not bad. It is in the nature of the mind to think. The Buddha is very, very clear about this, that what you experience through your senses. This is the basis for cognitive activity. And part of cognitive activities is conceptual discursive thinking. This is the nature of mind. And there are many positive qualities of thought, you know. You've noticed that the type of thoughts I've been speaking of as hindrances are all thoughts that are connected with desire and connected with anger or connected with agitation or connected with doubt. There are other types of thoughts, thoughts that are aspiring, thoughts that are wholesome, thoughts that are clarifying. Yeah, there's plenty of use for thought. You can't really make an anti-intellectual out of the Buddha or even a thought hater or something. You need to have the capacity to engage with thought. You can't be awakened, you can't be enlightened simply by no neocortical activity or so. Yeah, that's not the option. Even pre-verbal states are not really the option. The Buddha makes fun of, on one occasion, he makes fun of some Brahmins who say that, no, it's not Brahmins, it's somebody else who says that the problem begins with thought. And then he says, you know, every newborn baby would be enlightened if this was true, because it doesn't have yet, as far as we know, formed out discursive concepts like we. The Buddha does not believe that the problem is thought. The problem is ignorance. Yeah. It's not that if we stop thinking, all is well. There are some spiritual teachers, even nowadays, who proclaim that, but the Buddha would not find delight with this. He was very clear that the problem is ignorance, mostly, and then forms of desire and aversion. And under the influence of ignorance, we believe that we can be happy by following desire and aversion. Thought just complicates the matter, but it's not the root problem. Contrary, it's indispensable that we're capable of thinking and understand and use our intelligence, even cognitive intelligence. Good, very last one, but then definitely finished for tonight. Walking meditation. Would you leave me a chance to speak about this tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Let's.